Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage's completely online process lets you get a custom mortgage solution wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Today, we the people are electing the next president of the United States. On one side, a woman who could shatter that historic glass ceiling. On the other, a tycoon populist who has run a campaign like no other. The election season has been brutal, seeming to set new lows for discourse and distrust. Big, deep questions out there about the direction of the country. We need some perspective on how the country has come through tough election battles before. This hour on Point, historic election battles as the country makes history now. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What does election history tell us about how this country evolves, changes, decides its vote, how it fights, and then goes on? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Just in case you think the language of this election might have no precedent in earlier elections, let's listen back for just a second. A few years back, libertarian magazine Reason took the actual words of John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, things they really said about each other, and put together a pair of attack ads that could have run with those words if television had existed back in the early 19th century. Here's the Jefferson ad.
John Adams is a blind, bald, crippled, toothless man who wants to start a war with France. While he's not busy importing mistresses from Europe, he's trying to marry one of his sons to a daughter of King George. Haven't we had enough monarchy in America?
Okay, no patty cake there. And here, an ad from John Adams, imagined with his own words, calling Jefferson a mean-spirited lowlife, and then...
If Thomas Jefferson wins, murder, robbery, rape, adultery, and incest will be openly taught and practiced. The air will be rent with the cries of the distressed. The soil will be soaked with blood and the nation black with crimes. Are you prepared to see your dwellings in flames?
There. Thank you, Reason Magazine. We go back two centuries. Now, on Election Day, we try to avoid partisan politics, but we do want perspective today. We have two wonderful historians with us to share some. From New Haven, Connecticut, Beverly Gage is with us, presidential historian at Yale University. Beverly Gage, welcome back, and thanks for spending part of your Election Day with us.
No place I'd rather be, Tom.
Wonderful to have you. And from Nashville, Tennessee, John Meacham, presidential historian and Pulitzer Prize-winning author of American Lion on Andrew Jackson, Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, and just out in paperback, Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. John Meacham, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you right here today.
Happy Election Day, Tom.
Beverly, you look mainly at 20th century history. John, you've looked a lot at 19th century history. What on earth was going on in the time of the tape we just heard? Now, that was sort of jimmied together, but it was from the actual words of Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. Should that give us solace that this pretty rough and tumble campaign we've just come through is not without precedent in terms of rhetorical flair, shall we say?
Absolutely. There's always been a sense of ultimacy about American politics. There's a great Columbia historian, Robert Ferguson, who laid this out once, arguing that if you were on the more Enlightenment side of the role of reason over revelation, then you believe the American Republic was reason's great stand in the world. And so whoever led that nation not only had the affairs of the country, the affairs of the federal government, being the chief magistrate, as they used to call it, in his hands, but had in fact the entire experiment in reason over revelation. If you are more more theologically inclined, then you believe that the United States has been set apart for a certain special purpose, as Ronald Reagan, in an improvement on Jesus, I might add. Jesus said, city on a hill. Reagan added shining. And so only Reagan could help the Gospels along. But if you believe – I made that point to Mrs. Reagan once. I said, you know, your husband spoke more vividly than Jesus. And she said, well, yeah. yes, I think so. She did not disagree.
That's great at so many levels. Okay,
that's a true story. But if you believe that we're a special city, a special place, then you have an ultimate sense of who should lead it. So, covering the spectrum from secular to theological, you have this this sense of ultimacy. 1796, which was the first Adams Jefferson race, the first competitive race, because Washington was unopposed on both occasions. That was highly charged in the sense of the New England papers said up in Beverly's part of the world said you can have God and Adams or Jefferson and no God. So we've been through this before.
I want to play a little more tape from times when things did not work out so well and from times when they were very tough, but they worked out. November 6th election, 1860, the stakes could not have been higher. 1860, Abraham Lincoln would be elected to lead a nation that was then hurtling toward war. For the South, Lincoln was the enemy. And here's a reading from an Atlanta newspaper editorial recreated in the History Channel documentary, Civil War Election of 1860.
Let the consequences be what they may. Whether the Potomac is crimsoned in human gore, and Pennsylvania Avenue was paved 10 fathoms with mangled bodies, the South will never submit to such humiliation and degradation as the inauguration of Abraham Lincoln.
That did not turn out well. Civil War, of course, followed and followed quickly. Other times of great strain, the country made its way through. This was 3 days before the 1936 election. In a speech at Madison Square Garden, incumbent President Franklin Delano Roosevelt pledged to continue the New Deal and harshly criticized those who, in his view, were putting personal gain in politics ahead of national economic recovery from the Great Depression.
Never before in all our history have these forces been so united against one candidate as they stand today. They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
FDR, Beverly Gage, this is your century, the 20th century. Now here we are in the 21st, and people shaking their heads and feeling like there has never been anything quite like this. When you look at the 20th century, do you see elections or an election that might match this for a kind of sense of deep division and maybe even a little off the rails-ness, Beverly?
Well, you suggested that it was sort of comforting to think that actually Americans have often been deeply, deeply divided, have hurled lies and insults at each other throughout our politics. And so there's a way in which you can say that is comforting, or you can say, oh, this has always been a terrible, terrible system. But however you come down on that question, I certainly think that it's true. We're seeing some new features this year and a few pieces that we haven't seen before. But simply the fact of deep division, talk of hatred, and really in some ways apocalyptic language is in fact something that we've seen pretty often in American politics.
When you look at the 20th century, what election or elections would you point to where we may have had something on the order of 2016 level division, amped rhetoric? Where would you point, Beverly?
I think I would look back to the elections of the 60s, so particularly 1964 and 1968. So 1964 was the Johnson-Goldwater election, and of any candidates that have really ramped up the rhetoric, and in particular, I think caused a crisis within the Republican Party, Goldwater is probably our best precedent of sorts for Trump. Now, of course, people look back on Goldwater and say, oh, Goldwater seems like such a reasonable man. But in 1964, you know, the language of that campaign was that Goldwater was going to bring on a global nuclear war, that he was going to divide the country along racial lines. And there was a lot of a really dramatic conflict around that. 1968 as well, right? It was another year. I mean, it was a year of deep, deep violence in the presidential campaign and, frankly, much deeper violence than anything that we've seen this year. So the assassination of Martin Luther King, the assassination of Robert Kennedy, all of the violence at the Democratic National Convention, and again, really a sense that in this Nixon-Humphrey debate and campaign that things had gone a little off the rails and people were worried that the country was really coming apart at the seams.
I want to take our listeners back to some of that 1964 contest that you remind us of. Republican nominee This was Arizona Senator Barry Goldwater. He lost in a landslide to Lyndon Johnson in 64. But Goldwater was a staunch anti-communist. And here's one of his ads, American school children from TV, reciting the Pledge of Allegiance when the video abruptly cuts, or the TV anyway, to images of the Russian leader Nikita Khrushchev holding up a sign with the words, "Your children will be communists." Take a listen. You'll hear from Goldwater at the end.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America.
Оглядывайтесь, мы вас не добили под Сталинградом, а в Украине, в
Беларуси.
I want American kids to grow up as Americans, and they will, if we have the guts to make our intentions clear. So clear they don't need translation or interpretation, just respect for a country prepared as no country in all history ever was.
LBJ's campaign, of course, depicted him as a kind of maniac who should not be near the nuclear code, with the famous Daisy ad featured then 2-year-old actress Monique Louise, who's made a new appearance in Hillary Clinton ads this year. She was sitting in a field counting daisy petals, or counting fades into a countdown to an atomic bomb explosion, and Lyndon Baines Johnson delivers a warning about all that.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Zero.
These are the stakes: to make a world in which all of God's children can live. We must either love each other, or we must die.
John Meacham, you can't get much more apocalyptic a reference than that in 1964.
No. And the Republicans used to say, in your heart, you know he's right about Goldwater. And the Democrats retorted, in your guts, you know he's nuts. So we've been to this dance before. I do think that the Cold War context from the Second World War really through the 1992 election, from Truman's accession to the presidency to the end of communism on Christmas Day 1991, informed presidential elections with a level of drama that they did not have previously or since.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about big presidential election contests in American history, the ones that jolted, challenged the country, and how the country dealt with them. Before Hamilton got his musical, there was Bloody Andrew Jackson, a musical homage to our nation's controversial 7th president, Andrew Jackson. A taste of it right there from the soundtrack. John Meacham has written about Andrew Jackson, an American Lion. He wrote Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, Destiny and Power, about George H.W. Bush, just out in paperback. Pulitzer Prize-winning presidential historian joins us today from Nashville, Tennessee. Beverly Gage is with us from Yale University, presidential historian there, professor of 20th century history, author of The Day Wall Street Exploded, A Story of America in the First Age of Terror. You can join us on this election day. What does history tell us about how presidential campaigns can serve as wake-up calls about how this country absorbs the friction, the heat of presidential campaigns, and keeps on going, right? We've dipped a little bit into the 20th century, the 19th, and we'll dip a lot more. Callers for you, John and Beverly. Paul in Story City, Iowa. Paul, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Well, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just done the case of Jefferson and Adams. These men actually, later in life, had a lively correspondence. In my view, they actually loved each other. And on the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence on July 4th, 1826, in the afternoon, John Adams was dying, and he said, at least Jefferson still lives. And in reality, they both died on the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. And what a wonderful, almost romantic story that's stranger than fiction. And one more tidbit.
Mm-hmm.
I just think in this election, we're finally finding out what would have happened if Huey Long had been nominated for president.
We'll go to both of those, Paul, and I really appreciate your call. John Meacham, take us back first. I mean, we heard at the very top of the hour this really tough language from Jefferson and Adams when they fought in 1800 for the presidency, that he's, you know, Jefferson saying Adams is importing mistresses from Europe, and Adams saying, you know, your home will be in flames. And then, of course, there's the deathbed love story and much more in between. Why was it so fiery in the first place? How did they resolve that?
I think in many ways, and the caller is right to point this out, in many ways the Adams-Jefferson relationship mirrors both the best and the worst of our politics, because they did fall out. They were comrades during the Revolution. As Jefferson pointed out, Adams was always his senior. Adams, much to his eternal chagrin, actually deferred to Jefferson to write the Declaration of Independence. Adams, being a lawyer, believed that the most important revolutionary document of the Second Continental Congress was the order to reorganize the state governments. That's not exactly what people want to read at the fireworks show. And so Jefferson comes in and writes the poetry. And as Adams once said, the Declaration was entirely a piece of theatricality, and Jefferson ran away with all the glory of it. But then they opposed each other. They came to different views of the road the Republic should take, but shared a common bond, a common interest in the ongoing existence of that republic. I have a slightly revisionist view. I don't think they ever fell out personally as far as a lot of people do. But unquestionably, only after Jefferson's presidency, when Benjamin Rush played a kind of study hall role of telling Adams that Jefferson wanted to correspond with him and telling Jefferson that Adams did. And they finally began what was an amazing correspondence. Oh, you see a little bit of that with Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush at this point. And I think that what it reminds us of is that you can, as Jefferson put it, have extraordinary differences of opinion without having differences of principle.
John, in the 19th century, apart from 1860, when civil war was on the line and the Union, in fact, failed, were there other presidential contests in which Americans were saying, good Lord, is this republic going to hold together?
Well, 1860 was in fact, the one. I mean, you can go to 1824 and 28. Jackson won the popular vote in 1824, but the election goes to the House. John Quincy Adams becomes president. Jackson believed there had been a corrupt bargain in which Henry Clay became the Secretary of State. The road to the presidency in those days ran through the State Department. Jefferson had been Secretary of State. Madison had been. Monroe had been. John Quincy Adams had been. But interestingly, to my mind, Jackson did not try to relitigate the 1824 election. He simply began focusing entirely on the next one. And he won. And there were his opponents.
So he felt robbed, but he didn't say robbed, rigged.
Exactly. He did not try to reopen the process. He accepted the constitutional order and then went to the people, went back and ran again. And people did believe, let's be clear, that Andrew Jackson was an American Bonaparte, that he was a military chieftain who was going to destroy the country. Jackson once said his only two regrets in public life were that he had not shot Henry Clay and hung John C. Calhoun. And John C. Calhoun was his own vice president. It's arguable that no one felt that way until John McCain. But in any event, I think these elections feel existential in part because they are. The passions of the moment, the founders understood this, the framers understood that the key to a durable republic was a restraint of passion. The framers could not fully anticipate in any way the big, raucous democratic politics of modern presidential elections. But they did understand human nature. They understood it was sinful. They understood we are driven by ambition and appetite. And so they gave us an order which would endure despite the passions of the moment. And that's how we've gotten through these moments.
Beverly Gage, our caller from Iowa, raises Huey Long, of course, who had been governor of Louisiana and looked lined up for a presidential run. He was assassinated a month before. Maybe he was going to announce that in 1935, I think. But what about Huey Long and the his style of politics and whether we're seeing echoes of it today, how unusual that might be, or part of the American fabric?
Yeah, there's been a big search for sort of precedents for Donald Trump, and Huey Long is one of the people that a lot of folks have looked to. So it's partly a stylistic precedent, which is to say that Huey Long kind of went out and said what he wanted to say and claimed to be the only person really telling the truth to the American people. At the time, there was a big debate about whether Huey Long was really on the left or on the right, but he was basically a populist on the one hand, calling for a sort of major redistribution of wealth. And then on the other hand, many people in the 30s described him as a fascist, as a sort of demagogue in the model of people who were, in fact, springing up around the world at that moment, most notably Adolf Hitler. So he always had this very confused political identity. I think when people evoke him, they're mostly evoking this idea of the kind of populist demagogue who's going to stir people up and sort of say things that seem to be a little beyond the bounds of normal political convention.
Joe in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Joe, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom, and hi, Beverly and John. Along the same lines as Huey Long, I think of 1904, where Teddy Roosevelt ran. I think of Teddy Roosevelt as similar in many ways to Trump in the same way that Huey Long was. That he was a populist demagogue, a militant national socialist, and short, I often call him the first fascist of the 20th century, coming right off of the Spanish-American War. There's that famous cartoon of Teddy Roosevelt as policeman of the world.
Beverly, how about it? Demagogue, militant, nationalist, socialist, fascist, Teddy Roosevelt?
One of the funny things about Teddy Roosevelt is, yes, you can say all of those things about him. You can also call him a progressive and a reformer and a visionary. and so he really is someone who has, I think, a very conflicted political legacy. I mean, stylistically, right, Teddy Roosevelt was known for being bombastic, for wanting to be out there kind of whipping up the masses, for, you know, bringing wrestlers and fighters into the White House, this whole sort of dramatic language of fighting and winning that was so much part of the Roosevelt ethos. And on the other hand, he's also seen, as I said, as the father of progressivism in this country, of a new sort of vision of an activist federal government, the way that it could be deployed to work on behalf of particularly the middle class, but also poor people and workers in the country.
Was he described at the time as beyond the pale somehow with his sort of brawler side? Or was, you know, did people say, what is happening there to the Republic? What's happening? Or, you know, do we go on? Is comedy dead? Did they say that kind of thing then or not?
Yeah, they did. I mean, many people found Teddy Roosevelt to be completely absurd as a political figure. But on the other hand, he was also, you know, quite popular, quite beloved. I mean, one of the things that really drove Teddy Roosevelt, too, that was quite notable in the public sphere was his own ego. Right. So he is president for
which is very
roughly,
unusual for politics.
Yeah,
oh,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
How
like
could that
in
happen in presidential politics?
Of course, but, he had come up through many public positions by the time he took the White House.
He'd been experienced. He'd worked in police politics. He'd worked in the civil service. He'd worked, you know, certainly in the war itself, the Spanish-American War. But, you know, one of the funny things about Teddy Roosevelt as a political figure, he has his moment in the White House, and it's a long moment, so almost mm-hmm. two full terms, because mm-hmm. he becomes president when McKinley is assassinated in 1901. And then he decides that he is going to step down, and William Howard Taft is going to come in, and then he just can't let go. So he comes
Savage
back in 1912 as first trying to get the Republican nomination back from Taft and then running on his own progressive party, which is something that's pretty unprecedented in politics. But you can see that within parties, big, big rifts, some of which we're seeing in their own way playing out this year, those big rifts not only between the two major party candidates, but within parties themselves have really been one of the most driving and dramatic forces in presidential elections.
John, we've got listeners asking about civil conflict and whether Americans have seen presidential elections in which they feared, however distantly, and again, I guess we have to say apart from the Civil War, where it was standing right there, and maybe we shouldn't avoid that entirely. But first, apart from that, can you cite other times when people thought this could come to some kind of blows if it goes one way or another.
Beverly may be able to correct me on this. My clearest memory of that is in 1800, when the election went to the House again because of a hiccup in the Electoral College where Jefferson and Aaron Burr ended up with the same number of electoral votes, though they were running mates. And there was talk of a president pro tem until this could be ironed out. And the talk was of John Marshall, who had just had been Secretary of State, had just become Chief Justice, and is one of the sources of Jefferson's great hostility toward his cousin from Virginia. And the governors of Pennsylvania and of Virginia both prepared to call out the militias in order to march to Washington. The governor of Pennsylvania, I believe, actually said that if any congressman were to vote to take the election away from Jefferson, they would be arrested once they came home to Pennsylvania. But there has been one of the remarkable things about the Republic is a, by and large, a willingness to accept the result, even when we had an 1824, even when we had an 1876, even when we had a 2000. And I think I think we owe a great deal of that, not only to the framers and the constitutional order and the peaceable result of 1800, but also ultimately to the character of the major party candidates, which they have tended to, whether it was Nixon in 1960 or Al Gore in 2000, they have tended to try to put the country above party and person.
Let's hear two of those fraught moments. 1960, Vice President Richard Nixon faced Massachusetts Senator John F. Kennedy. It was expected to be close. Election night 1960, Americans glued to their TV sets and radios until after dawn at 4 a.m. Nixon virtually acknowledged Kennedy had won. Here he was.
I want Senator Kennedy to know, and I want all of you to know, that certainly if this trend does continue and he does become our next president, that he will have my wholehearted support.
You can hear the shouts of no there. Not an easy speech to make, but Nixon made it. And December 13th, well after Election Day, the year 2000, not so long ago, here's Vice President Al Gore conceding the election to George W. Bush after that grueling 36-day Florida recount battle. Ultimately, the Supreme Court had stepped in and said and stopped the recount. That made Bush president. Here was Al Gore.
Now the U.S. Supreme Court has spoken. Let there be no doubt, while I strongly disagree with the court's decision, I accept it. I accept the finality of this outcome, which will be ratified next Monday in the Electoral College. And tonight, for the sake of our unity as a people and the strength of our democracy, I offer my concession.
Beverly, what about concession after bitterly contested fights? Is there a precedent for not conceding?
There, aside from 1860, right, aside from the Civil War, when you could argue that an entire section of the country did not concede, most candidates have really, as John said, stepped up and said, I accept the results. So Nixon in 1960, in really a razor-thin election, one that many people would still actually contest, but Nixon himself said, I'm not actually going to file appeals, though there were a few appeals filed in places like Illinois and Texas, allegations of corruption. Nixon himself came forth and said, we need to move on. I'm going to accept the results of the election.
John, can you think of a precedent for just saying, other than the Civil War, as Beverly says, when a whole segment of the country opted out, but a candidate who said, nope, won't accept?
No, I can't. And I think that the Gore moment in particular is an extraordinary one because of the conversations we've heard in 2016 about being kept in suspense about whether or not one candidate would accept the result. And I think that what Vice President Gore did was an enormous service to the country. And, you know, character is destiny, right? And one of the things we do in presidential elections is we are not only choosing a set of policies, we're choosing habits of heart and mind, because none of us know what history is going to throw at these folks once they get behind the desk. And I think that's why it's so important to have a sense of who they are.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings home financing into the 21st century with a completely online process that's fast, easy, and convenient. Using a phone or tablet, you can safely share bank statements and pay stubs without having to dig through piles of paperwork. It takes just a few minutes to get a custom mortgage solution on your terms, wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org number 3030.
I for president. You like Ike. I like Ike. Everybody likes Ike. For president.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. On Election Day 2016, we are looking back on big presidential election contests in American history, the ones that jolted, challenged, changed the country, and how the country dealt with them. Doesn't sound too difficult there in a Dwight Eisenhower ad from 1952. Irving Berlin wrote his campaign song. Walt Disney Studios made one of his television ads, and you can kind of hear that Disney sound right there. The first campaign ads aired that season on TV. John Meacham and Beverly Gage are with us today, presidential historians from New Haven and Nashville, Tennessee today, and you're welcome to join us as well. Lots of precedents in American history. Donald Trump, certainly not the first rich outsider to jump in. 1992, three candidates for president squared off on the debate stage. Incumbent George H.W. Bush, Democratic then nominee Bill Clinton, and independent candidate Ross Perot. Interesting now to listen back to the Texas billionaire talking tough on NAFTA.
First thing you ought to do is get all these folks who've got these one-way trade agreements that we've negotiated over the years and say, fellas, we'll take the same deal we gave you. And they'll gridlock right at that point.
Right at that point. Now, the giant sucking sound, Ross Perot warned, of jobs going to Mexico and beyond. And here it is again, 2016, back in our laps, back in the middle of this campaign. Jatika is calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Jatika, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. Mm-hmm. You know, I grew up at a time when Bobby Kennedy was running, and there was so much passion and enthusiasm. Not-
Jatika, are you there?
We
lost you for a second. You said passion and enthusiasm, and what does it have you thinking today? Oh, we got a tough line with Jatika, but she's saying, I think, will we ever feel that way again, at least from Jatika's corner, Beverly, that positive passion and enthusiasm of the Kennedy campaign and wondering when that comes back. What have you thought about the tenor of 2016 compared? Is there a sense in the main of what people have felt, you know, either enthused or dispirited in presidential campaigns in the 20th century, Beverly?
Right. Well, looking at 1968, which is when Robert Kennedy was out there as a candidate of great hope and promise for many people, and then, of course, was assassinated. You know, I think that really captures some of the spirit of that moment, which is that for many people, it was their most energized political moment. It seemed full of the hope and promise of the 60s. On the other hand, also really a sort of dark moment to look to, and a sense of division and violence really penetrating the political system. So I think one of the interesting questions to be asking about the present is, are people looking to the future with a lot of hope about what the political system is going to deliver? And that, to me, is one of the more alarming trends wherever you're coming down in this presidential election, is that the answer increasingly seems to be no, that people's sense of what can be delivered in a positive way through active political participation has really been damaged in recent years, that many people would articulate what they're doing this year, however they're voting, as being a vote against and not a vote for. And that, to some degree, has always been the case. Right? Enemies tend to motivate and create really strong coalitions. On the other hand, as a more general trend about people's faith in our political institutions and our political system, I think that's pretty troubling.
I mean, it's not that long, John, since there was that feeling in the air, certainly for Barack Obama supporters. I've got a little tape here of 2008. Anybody who was around then remembers. Of course, he defeated John McCain, became the 44th president of the United States, country's first African-American leader. And that sense of hope in the Obama camp and beyond was pretty wild. Here he was in Chicago's Grant Park celebrating with 125,000 supporters.
If there is anyone out there who still doubts that America is a place where all things are possible, who still wonders if the dream of our founders is alive in our time, who still questions the power of our democracy, tonight is your answer.
And the huge cheer comes up. John, what about, through your historical lens, that ratio of hope versus fear or disillusion over time? Campaign years bring it to a head one way or another. Where do you see that? Is there a mean we can point to? And how wide's the variation? Where do you find us in 2016 in that spectrum?
Well, I'm a biographer, so I believe that the human drama is ultimately dispositive. And if you think about the period 1960 to 1980, for instance, mm-hmm. I hope history should not be intellectual Zoloft, but this might help mm-hmm. a little bit today. We had five American presidents in 20 years. We lost one to assassination. We lost one to a terribly misguided war in Vietnam. We lost one to resignation, and then Ford and Carter. And Carter lost to Ronald Reagan in 1980 at a point when some people were openly asking whether the presidency had become too complex a job for any one person. And then along comes a man who had made his name giving a speech the week before the election for Barry Goldwater. Mm-hmm. And Ronald Reagan, for all his flaws, restored confidence in the broad presidency. Led to 12 years of one-party rule, which we had not had. No vice president had succeeded directly a sitting president since Jackson and Van Buren. And you point out exactly, 8 years ago, we had an extraordinary history. Given the original sins of American life, African-American slavery and Native American removal, the idea that we are coming to the end of 8 years with a president, Barack Hussein Obama, whose approval rating is now as high as that man I just mentioned, Ronald Reagan, when he was leaving office in 1988, and that there is a live chance that the first female president, only 96 years after suffrage, is about to succeed the first African-American president, I know we're down. I know it's been awful. My children ask me to define words that are said on the news that I'd rather not. Mm-hmm. But in the fullness of time, in the broadest perspective, we're in pretty good shape, I think.
Some women may look at those 96 years and say that's a long time, I suppose.
Well, but in the tectonic shifts of history,
true.
Not totally get it. In the 19th Amendment, was too long in coming. But the founders were right in the great phrase: "We're just looking for a more perfect union, not a perfect one."
Beverly, between intellectual Zoloft and despair, I mean, you say you're a little worried about maybe more than a little worried about the absence of hope in this year's election season compared to the historical mean, if there is one, of hope. What about that more positive view that there have been progressive steps, if that's what you're looking for?
Right. Well, there's a very powerful part of the American political story that is a progress story, right? It's about a story of expanding liberty and expanding opportunity. And then there is a much darker narrative of the United States, which mm-hmm. is about deep and often violent conflict over all sorts of things, including race, to some degree, including gender, including class, including a whole set, sometimes including partisanship and political parties themselves. So these stories are, I think, always in tension. I think one thing that has been alarming to some people is the idea that what we are seeing from that moment of hope and promise with Obama's election is a kind of backlash and rejection of what that moment represented. But again, those things have always tended to go together, right? The gains of the civil rights movement produced massive resistance that produced a lot of conflict between these two visions. So I don't don't think it's a settled story this year. There have been pieces of each of these stories about the American past and present playing out in this election.
Ron in Nashville, Tennessee. Ron, you're on the air. Thank you very much for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Hey, just a quick comment, and I'll let your guest address this. You know, we feel like we live in turbulent times politically now, but if you go back in history, gang, just 100 to 150 years, we actually had three presidents who were assassinated over about a 35-year period, starting with Lincoln, then James Garfield, and then, of course, William McKinley. So just let you guys discuss that, banner it about, and John Meacham, go Swanee. Have a great day.
All right. Nashville speaks.
That's right.
I do think that's a good point that we – so there's I think, a lot of concern about violence in this election. But relative to the way that presidential elections went, certainly in the 19th century, both in terms of assassination but also in terms of the levels of violence that were often occurring at polling places, both in the South and at northern cities, we're actually living in a pretty calm moment if we're just measuring levels of actual violence within our politics.
But of course, that was the period with those three assassinations, 65 to 1901, which came immediately after the Civil War, the time when everything failed, John. I mean, we should think for us about how America binds its wounds, if that's what they has emerged after a presidential campaign season, versus in that spectacular and terrible example, how it fails. What works toward the binding? Where should we watch out for the potential failing?
Well, I mean, the cataclysm of the Civil War is obviously of an entirely different magnitude than a presidential election. The pain of Reconstruction, the reaction in my native region, the imposition of Jim Crow, the attempt to delegitimize the ultimate benefits of the Union victory have shaped our politics ever, you know, unto this hour, unquestionably, and particularly in the 1960s, as we've discussed. I hate to be a materialist about this, mm-hmm. or sound like Adam Smith reincarnated, but it is also a historical fact that democracies tend to the strength of democracies is often proportionate to economic growth and to the widest distribution of the fruits of economic growth. The fact that in many ways the American Revolution was the political manifestation of the emergence of the idea that the divine right of kings and princes and prelates was breaking down, and that we all had our own destiny to work out, and we had our right, the right to rise, as Lincoln would say, would ultimately say. Mm. And so whoever the next president of the United States is, whoever the 45th president is, it seems to me has two numbers they have to worry about. One is 135,000. Which is the number that the White House estimates is required in household income to live a post-World War II style middle-class life. And the household income in the country, as you all know, is about $57,000. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that gap is hugely important. And the other is 19%, which is the Gallup number for trust in the federal government. It's down from 77% in 1965. So we've gone from a point at which three out of four Americans trusted Washington to fewer than one in five. And I think that the binding of the wounds will work in proportion to the winner of the presidential election's ability to increase prosperity and increase trust.
Beverly, those are daunting numbers. I mean, if you got to go from 57,000 household income to 135 in the main to have that middle class comfort, to go from 19% trust up to the very much higher levels, does that augur a kind of re-coalescing or of consensus around a way forward, or are we headed straight into more turbulence? But if history can tell us, guide us.
Well, the answer is kind of always both. Right? Mm-hmm. So I think mostly after presidential elections, there is not a great moment of healing and coming together. I mean, so we live in an era of incredibly close elections by historical standards. So for much of the 20th century, presidential elections, though there were exceptions, they tended to be not particularly close elections. There are a few exceptions, like 1960. So to some degree, we are living in a kind of unique period mm-hmm. along those lines. But mostly, it is a matter of soldiering on after the presidential election, as opposed to, I think, very self-conscious healing. The problems that were there before are here again. And I think in terms of inequality and the kind of pressing economic questions that John was mentioning, you know, it is interesting to look back and see that we are now approximately at the levels of inequality that we saw 100 years ago in this country. That inequality shrank some in the middle part of the century, and now it has widened once again. So to some degree, to the sense that this has been an election that's about populist energy, that's not very surprising, because that is a lot of what was going on in the late 19th and early 20th century, too, a kind of upwelling of populist energy, the first big P populist movements coming out of that moment. And so the question of what happens with that populist energy, how we solve these much larger problems, those are going to be there tomorrow. They're going to be there in January, and they're going to remain.
John, if Americans on this election day want to look back for ideals or principles or precedent that might encourage the healing or positive way forward, what would you point them to in the historical record?
I think I might look at 1932, which sounds perhaps counterintuitive given the economic calamity of that time. But in the summer of 32, Franklin Roosevelt told one of his speechwriters that the two most dangerous men in America were Huey Long and Douglas MacArthur, because Long could lead a populist revolt from the left, and Douglas MacArthur, as Army Chief of Staff, might be able to lead a populist revolt from the right. And yet the year ends with the election of FDR, who was entirely a creature of the political class, had one of the most famous political names. Someone named Roosevelt had already been president.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll leave it with this. As Mark Twain once said, history may not repeat itself, but it does rhyme.
Well, we'll see what that rhyme looks like tomorrow morning, if indeed we have a clear outcome tomorrow morning. It's been wonderful to spend some time with the two of you today looking back to maybe help us look at our present more effectively and at our future. I'm really grateful to each of you. John Meacham, author of Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, author of Destiny and Power, now out in paperback on George H.W. Bush, American Lion on Andrew Jackson. John, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Beverly Gage, presidential historian at Yale University. Beverly, it's always wonderful to have you. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, if you haven't already, go and vote. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.